good to be here.
All right. Sorry about the late delay, ladies and gentlemen. I was just on a previous show. Kevin, do you have a webcam by chance? If you could turn that on, that'd be lovely.
If I can figure out how to do it, that would be lovely.
there's a button that looks kind of like a camera,
yes,
which would indicate a webcam. And if you click it, it turns the webcam on, surprisingly enough. All right. So, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. We're on live 5 days a week, ladies and gentlemen, for your listening pleasure. My very special guest right now is Kevin Galilee. And speaking of the Sea of Galilee, it turns out that there's a bit of a war going on in Fiordland, the South Island of New Zealand, over how much cod people can catch, how much blue cod specifically. And I say, don't make war over cod, just have a cod piece, all right? And now we're going to turn it over to Kevin Galilee. Please tell us a little bit about who you are and what it is you do.
Well, I am a Canadian citizen, first of all. For the past 4 years, I have done exclusively nothing but human rights activism, or political activism, rather, to disastrous effects for my life, but not without success, might I add. Prior to that, I was a fine arts consultant and appraiser and a professional writer.
Mm-hmm. And if you were an appraiser, what was it that you were praising?
No, I was praising old master's paintings and drawings. I was an art dealer dealing in old master's paintings and drawings, and I specialized in Italian art, specifically from the Renaissance period, Mannerist, and early Baroque.
Probably worked for a whole lot of psychopathic, really rich, evil banking scum, didn't you?
Actually, I worked for myself, but I did sell to the large auction houses, Sotheby's and Christie's. But since buyers are remain anonymous, I have no idea who bought the works that I brought to the auction homes.
Ah, I think that's a yes. Okay. Anonymity, don't they? Human rights activism, what makes you go from such a prestigious career path into human rights activism, which will diminish your income, often deprive you of your liberties,
yeah,
and indeed make you lose a lot of your current circle of friends? What motivated you to do that?
Well, I basically fell into it. I was studying Oxford University. I was taking a summer course in 2009, and that just for my professional enrichment. And I was studying political philosophy for about 10 weeks. And that was in preparation for a master's degree in international relations and global order at Leicester University, another British university, that I was supposed to begin, and I indeed began a few months later. So as I was studying at Oxford University, online from the comfort of my own home, it became clear that the academic environment was heavily censored, and that my opinions and my outspoken manner were not welcomed at Oxford. So they created an incident and kicked me out of the course under the pretext that I had breached netiquette. That is to say, I had breached online etiquette, which was completely false. And because it was completely wrong, I appealed that decision. And I went from one adjudication level within the university to another. As this was going on for months and months and months, I began the master's program at Leicester University. And lo and behold, I encountered the exact same methodology of censorship. And in this case, I quit of my own accord because I said to the administration, I have no intention of paying my good money to attend a heavily censored university. It was my understanding that British universities are famous for academic freedom, and that is why I chose the British University, and that was a rude surprise to me, and I would rather spend my hard-earned money elsewhere. So I withdrew from the master's program. And
you dropped out of university for the same reason I did, you know. Mm-hmm. I think they gave me an essay to write about television, and one of the arguments was anti-television discourse. And for the very first time ever, you know, this really interested me. And the reference notes, actually read source material for the first time ever, backed up my arguments, bibliography, the whole nine yards, and they gave me a D minus. And I was like, this is the best essay I've ever written. And they gave me a D minus? Because I'm talking about how bad television is for people, and their argument is that television's really good because it brings people together in a nice, homogenous soup.
Yeah, if you don't pay to the system, they you know, they burn you.
Yeah.
You are supposed to attend a university to enrich your views and knowledge, but instead they just want to create clone basically people the exact same way. People who are willing to toe the line will do as they are told. And that is not my idea of what a university should mean. So, but to go back to the to your initial question, I was going from one adjudication level to the next, and at first I thought it was just the nature of Oxford University. It's a conservative university. You know, my specific tutor was a conservative Italian fella. So I thought it was just an isolated incident. But as I moved on from one adjudication to the next, it became clear that that the course tutor had the full support of the administration, that they were hiding the true reasons of my expulsion, and that they were hiding something else. So by going on and on and on, through these levels of adjudication, I was able to access more and more information. So, but because I was able to compare my experience at Oxford with my experience at Leicester, it became clear that another entity was behind this censorship program. And as I dug deeper and deeper, I discovered that indeed the British government had instituted a program under a white policy paper called CONTEST, which is Britain's a strategy for combating terrorism and countering radicalization. And due to this program, the government had infiltrated two-thirds of Britain's universities and had installed censors in sensitive courses, such as political philosophy, I would imagine also nuclear physics, and so on. And as I was studying political philosophy, I was in one such sensitive course, my opinions were not welcome, so I was kicked out. But once I finished my phony adjudications within the university and I did not get the justice that I thought I deserved, I was able to take my case to the highest adjudication level, to a national organization within the UK, which is called the OIA, the Office of the Independent Adjudicator. And there, of course, I had even more access to information, and I presented a better case. Nevertheless, their decision was a complete whitewash. So, now that I had finished with the highest adjudication level within the UK, I was able to take my case to an international court. So I did that. I went to the I sued the British government at the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, France. And that is how my human rights work, or my political activism, began.
And let me guess, they didn't give you your tutorage fees back, did they?
Actually, they did refund my money.
All of it?
But of course, they didn't allow me back into the Oxford course. I had only 2 or 3 weeks left to finish it, and they were adamant that they wouldn't let me. But through the Freedom of Information request that I had made, I also discovered that I had been banned from Oxford for the duration of my entire life. From any and all courses and programs offered by Oxford University. In other words, I was persona non grata at Oxford University because of my opinions, I guess, are too
rational,
radical,
logical, actually giving a frackical, you know, these people are freaking nuts. And I don't know about you, but I hate people who are university educated that actually believe that they're educated. They're not educated, they're trained.
It is my experience, Vinny, that the dumbest people on earth are have the highest university degrees, and I have come to this realization, you know, through a lot of pain and experience. If you would have asked me the same question 10 years ago, I would have given you the exact opposite answer, as I held people with education in high regard. But it appears that people nowadays are educated, and they're educated in very particular fields, very narrow, with very narrow focus, And they are what sociologists once called them trained incapacities. That is to say, they know a lot about a very, very narrow field, and they are completely blind to everything else.
There was an article coming out of Natural News by Mike Adams, I believe, talking about how those people who are in specialist fields are in fact usually the least intelligent of people in general. And those who are widely educated in a number of different topics, in fact, the more the better, the smarter you become because you're capable of pulling in information from a number of different data points. Whereas somebody who is perhaps, I don't know, let's say they're a doctor, okay? Doctor knows everything about sickness, illness, so on and so forth, except how to treat it because they don't study nutrition.
I think you've made a good point there. I think universities have realized this, and this is why now they are putting together multidisciplinary academic programs, which is an absolute necessity, because people have lost the ability to see the entire picture. And at the worst time possible, because now for the first time ever we live in a global and extremely complex society, and now we need to have an overall picture, and at this time we lack just that. So to compensate for this abysmal lacuna, universities now are taking steps. So they've realized that education is just does not fit the intellectual and the social environment of our days.
Well, it's much like somebody who's driving a really fast car, or somebody who goes to a really prestigious university on a giant campus. They're compensating for something.
Yes, I guess we all compensate for something or other. But unfortunately, we also live at a time when credentials are an absolute necessity. You know, here in Canada, and I don't know what the situation is like in New Zealand, but I suspect it is the same. You cannot get even a laborer's job without a high school diploma, and that is completely unnecessary. As to people with a BA, a Bachelor of Arts degree, or even an MA, even a Bachelor of Science degree, it does not get you any jobs. You have to continue and get a master's degree, perhaps a PhD, and then
get a job opportunity. and this has resulted in the United States as what's called full nest syndrome. Have you heard of this?
No.
Kid goes to school, you know, pays for their education.
Yes.
They get out, they're educated. I'll do that in inverted commas. They're educated. Then they find out, and this is where their education begins, that nobody gives a frack about their qualification. And they've got to move home, back in with mummy and daddy.
Yes.
Because they can't afford to pay for a house of their own. That's called full nest syndrome. It's happening all over the United States. Education doesn't matter anymore. Yeah. Okay? And this is the irony. You can't get a job without a qualification, yet even if you've got the qualification, you can't get a job.
No.
So it costs you 50 G's to go to a prestigious university, say like Harvard or what have you. Unless you're part of the elite club, right, your education doesn't matter. Because even if you're in, even if you're in said elite club, your education still doesn't matter. What matters is that you're in the club. And that's where you get your employment from. That's how you get into these massive round tables and think tanks and banking institutions and so on and so forth that actually really run society. You're in the club, or you're not.
And because that is the prerequisite for belonging to such clubs, the intellectual level within the ranks of the so-called think tanks, or even the Bretton Woods organizations such as the World Bank and the IMF, is abysmal. And that has been noted by insiders. The directors of these organizations have been lamenting for the past 20 years that the quality of their employees is decreasing.
Yeah, well, that's right. That's what happens when you stop people being educated, which means to learn how to think, and you start training them, which is learning how to follow orders and needing somebody to tell you orders in order to get anything done. We'll be right back.
To fly to New Zealand by plane from New York City, it takes 22 hours. So from the Twin Cities, 19. I mean, I fly all the time, and 6 hours on a plane is like a lot, and 19 is wrong. And they distract you. They feed you, and then they feed you some more, and then they feed you, give me a dessert, give me a dessert, give me a dessert. Have your dessert, you prick, give me that dessert. Have a Bloody Mary, yeah, give me a whiskey sour, yeah, give me whatever you got. Just more liquor, more liquor, more liquor. And then when you're done, there's still 16 hours to go.
Welcome back.
You want to know what it's like?
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, broadcasting live from New Zealand. It is the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Now, a lot of people have been getting into spirituality later, and what I find very interesting is, despite the fact that people are becoming more spiritual, the propensity for that spiritual belief to encourage depopulation seems to be very almost coinciding. Okay, it's like they go from Deepak Chopra to Depop Chopra in three easy steps. I don't get it, because I'm not insane. And my very special guest is Kevin Galilee. Welcome back.
Well, Vinny, that just so happens to be a subject that has been all-consuming for me for the past 2 years especially. I was telling you and your listener earlier how I evolved from a common citizen who was completely outside the loop and uninvolved in public policy or politics to somebody who is, if nothing else, overly involved. Once I discovered that program of censorship in Britain, and I was fighting for my reinstatement, I exposed a program which I named the covert program of censorship and surveillance, SAC for short, SAC. And I was asking myself questions, you know, why would the United Kingdom would need such a program? Obviously, it was pretty obvious that it was directed at Muslims, especially radical Muslims. But they were kicked out of the country within 6 months of the program being instituted. And afterwards, you know, the machinery was in place, but it was not just was not being shut down. It was growing in magnitude and scope. And this is how people like me, who I'm neither Muslim nor radical nor religious nor you know any threat to anybody. Certainly, there is no bone of terrorism in me whatsoever. I'm a most peaceful citizen. Nevertheless, I fell victim to that.
But under the Patriot Act, you are a terrorist if you use force, and force is defined as words or actions to accomplish a political goal. So yeah. Technically, you are a terrorist.
Anybody who contradicts or threatens the status quo these days is considered a threat to national security and therefore a terrorist. But my work was obviously very, very sensitive, because the moment I took my case to the European Court of Human Rights, and a month later, that was in May of 2011, I went in person to Strasbourg, France, to engage in a hunger strike so as to draw attention to this issue, because the media just refused to publish anything. And I thought that by my public hunger strike, I would basically force the media to confront this issue, but I was also trying to force the Council of Europe to condemn the program and to force the United Kingdom to reimburse all students who had fallen victim to this odious program. Of course, I was completely ignored. Even though I hungered there for 30 days and lost, you know, over 20% of my body weight, and I was addressing the Commissioner of Human Rights at the European Council, a fellow by the name of Thomas Hammarberg. They were paying attention, all right, but there was no indication that I was there publicly, and there was the French media or the Western media refused to publish absolutely a single word. So, but at the same time, while I was hungering there, for 30 days. The media was gung-ho about the hunger strike done by an Indian politician who only hungered for 7 days, and he was his issue was protesting against corruption in India. So that was front page news, whereas mine was completely left out of the news, even though I was right there in their face day and night at the European Council and at the European Court of Human Rights. So I knew something was fishy. Obviously, the program that I had touched upon was of international importance, and it was held taboo by the media. The moment I returned home after 30 days, I was arrested. 2 days after my return home to Canada from France, I was arrested. But what is ridiculous about this scenario is that I was not arrested for my human rights activism. I was arrested for having purportedly harassed my wife. It turns out that the fact that I took on this program and I basically shut it down. Actually, I did shut it down and caused, you know, a lot of havoc with the intelligence community in the UK and the European community. I had made a lot of enemies, not only within the government of the United Kingdom, but also in Canada, because we share the same head of state. And obviously, the order came that, you know, to the Canadian government, you guys better keep this guy quiet and keep him in the country. And in order to keep me quiet and keep me in the country to make sure that I wouldn't cause any more trouble in Europe, they arrested me for purportedly having harassed my wife. Well, lo and behold, while I was in Europe, my wife had been convinced by her family to go along with this. And I guess the initial plan was to just slap me over the finger, scare me into silence, and then, you know, everything would be okay. I'd fall in line, so they thought, and just play according to the rules. But I didn't. So one arrest led to another, and to another, and to another. So for the past 3 years, I have been arrested 6 times. I have had to flee the country for 10 months. When they came to arrest me the fifth time, that was in January of 2012, I was luckily not home. And my friends gave me the news that the police was looking for me. So I headed out east. I drove throughout the night and from Ontario, which is in the middle of the country, to Nova Scotia. Bypassed several roadblocks that appear to have been there specifically to stop me, I would imagine, because every entrance to the highway 401, which is the main highway connecting country from east to west, was had a police cruiser conspicuously placed there. So I didn't want to. I don't know. I cannot confirm that that was there for me, but it was very conspicuous. Nevertheless, to make a long story short, I bypassed all of these roadblocks. I headed east. I drove through the night. I stayed off the highways. 2 days later, I managed to cross into the United States by floating off a half-frozen river between Canada and the U.S. And so escaped the fifth arrest. So for the next 10 months, I spent my time in Florida where I have family. And continued to research and to write, and by that time I had become, famous in certain circles and infamous in others. And some media had taken an interest in me, and I was asked to write on issues of human rights and civil liberties, and I did so. But my research led me to the discovery that the program of surveillance and censorship that I had uncovered in Europe is nothing but an offshoot of the greater population control policy, which I have come to call the global depopulation policy. And this program was obviously needed to keep academics people who would come to graduate and take positions of importance, who could speak, you know, and against the status quo, to keep them in line. So they are basically breeding a new class of.
Yeah, that's right. You know, somebody told me that there's specified schools and educational institutions where the children of those in power, the elite or whatever, get taught an entirely different education to everybody else.
And that's why they need like league schools. Yeah. That's why they have Ivy League schools, and the way they ensure that only their own people study there is by making it unaffordable for the majority to attend a school like a university like Harvard or Princeton or Oxford costs, you know, tens of thousands, if not upwards of $100,000, which is out of reach for the vast majority of the public. So I published through my research. I published a book in 2011 called Water, Salt, Milk, Killing Our Unborn Children, where I reveal for the first time, as far as I know, that the governments of the world under the tutelage or the direction of the United Nations since 1945 have been using covert methods, chemical and biological methods of population control. And the reason they've been doing this is because population control post-World War II was the method of choice and the substitute to war that the international community had agreed to. Being traumatized by two world wars within a period of only four decades, the international community had decided to avoid a third world war by all means, especially since two nations had developed nuclear weapons. So war was no longer an alternative to solving internal problems, whether they are resource scarcity problems or political problems. Since nations could no longer go to war to solve their internal problems, it was decided that the only way to keep the peace and international peace is to control the population. That is to say, if countries do not outgrow their resources, then there will be no incentive there, no pressure to force them outwards so that they would start trouble with their neighbors and take resources from a weaker neighbor, which is what has happened throughout human history. Nations have invaded other nations, tribes have invaded neighboring tribes, and you name it, whatever social unit, however small or large, there has been war.
It sounds very similar to the Avengers film where the bad guy comes in from another dimension and says, I just want peace. Yeah. And Director Fury says, really? It sounds like you want the other thing.
Well, peace comes, it turns out, it comes at a very high price. Of course, in 1945, when the international community decided to avoid war at all costs and embarked on a course of population control as a substitute or an alternative to war, they could not foresee the problems that they would encounter. Because to control population, you have to take on two of the strongest human instincts. One is the instinct to procreate, and then the other is the survival instinct. And how do you do that? How do you convince people to go along with allowing governments to curtail their reproductive rights and limit the size of their families? Well, this issue even today is too hot to touch by politicians, but imagine how hot it was in 1945. In 1945, first of all, there was the historical context and the conditions. The environment was just not conducive to any kind of talk on these issues. The time they needed to act, and they needed to act quickly, and they realized that unless they act quickly, there will be another world war within a decade or two. And the third time, it would be completely disastrous because it would lead to assured mutual annihilation through nuclear weapons. So they began, they acted without people's knowledge or consent. And this is the very, very interesting aspect of this. In order to act without people's knowledge and consent, to attack people's reproductive rights and curtail the size of the family, they had to limit human fertility. And how do you limit human fertility without people's approval, without people's consent? You have to do it covertly. And how
or get them to choose to limit their own fertility by promoting contraception through the American Eugenics Society, which was renamed Planned Parenthood.
Yes. Yes, but you have to go back to 1945. Just stay with me and think about the environment in 1945. In 1945, any kind of talk on sexual matters or reproductive matters was taboo. People could not even tackle the most mundane issues without being accused of being obscene. This was not an issue that was adequate for those conservative times. So, in other words, there were certain obstacles in the way to legislating this or to educating the public to adopt, population control or to curtail their family size willingly, voluntarily. And these, in a subsequent book which I published recently, called "Killing Us Softly: Causes and Consequences of the Global Depopulation Policy," I basically, which is basically a short history of the global depopulation policy, I name all these obstacles that stood in the way, and the most important ones are systemic obstacles, and they're rather obvious once you start thinking about them. Not only was the public at that time unaware of the issue and unwilling to speak to talk about anything related to sex without falling victim to obscenity laws, there was a lack of birth control. The technology of controlling births was just not there. Only about 20% of the population was using condoms, for instance.
We'll come into break now. If you do want to get somebody to do something that they're unwilling to do, you've either got to do it covertly or just brainwash them into thinking they do want it. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. No one's gonna take me. Rocking it, ladies and gentlemen, rocking it on the Vinnie Eastwood Show. 5 days a week on American Freedom Radio, you will hear perspectives on the show that you will probably not hear anywhere else. Certainly not in the quantity, certainly not with the great variance that we have on this show. 5 days a week, I give the platform to anybody who my listeners suggest. And because my listeners themselves are very different people, very honourable generally, quite decent and honest people, we wind up getting people who represent their interests on the show at all times. And my very special guest today is Steve Galilee. And I would like to encourage people, if you are capable, my bank accounts are basically dry as a bone. I'm really sick of having to ask for donations, so I'm going to ask for them again. Until I get exactly what it is that I need. I need you, the listener, to support this broadcast only in a minimal capacity. Go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Subscribe for $5 a month. Just a $5 a month automatic payment, either directly into the bank account, the Kiwi Bank account that's got the numbers on there, or through PayPal. Having those regular contributions helps to consistently pay the bills and helps us to consistently fund this operation of Guerrilla Media and the Vinnie Eastwood Show to train activists how to do their own media so that they don't need me to do it for them anymore, and also for those who don't have the ability to get the word out on their own, we give them a free platform, free video making and everything so that we can indeed hear from them and get their message out there. Because if the population is not educated as to the reality of what is going on, if the only media that they have to choose from are liars, psychopaths, and the elite, no wonder they will wind up being in control. If you want good people, patriots, those with common decency and morality, to be in control of society, to be in control of themselves and maintain their own personal sovereignty, I need your help to do so. you have a moral obligation to help this kind of broadcast continue. Doesn't matter whether or not you're donating to me. There might be somebody else out there who you think might be more deserving of your support, but just give it to those who are doing the right thing, and you will see society change for the better inexorably. Done with that. Kevin Galloway, welcome back. You were talking about depopulation in the era after 1945, when human beings still had a very, very high level of morality, and talking about sex was something that was very, very much frowned upon. You were considered a deviant if you talked about it in public to a large degree. But now, deviancy is mainstream. It's all over every single conceivable music video you could ever think of. If anybody dressed like Lady Gaga in 1945, they probably would have been burned as a witch.
They would have been arrested under obscene and charged with obscenity laws. That was the environment then. So before I continue speaking about the early stages of the global depopulation policy, I want to thank Barry Hammond, who is your fan. Listener, and he connected us. He made this possible. So, I'm going now to 1945 to talk about the systemic obstacles that stood in the way to legislating population control and limiting family size. I mentioned that there was a lack of birth control and lack of public awareness. But the second important systemic obstacle is Christianity and the doctrine of papal infallibility. And this is going to raise some eyebrows. Now, since 1870, the Vatican has claimed that the Pope is the ultimate moral authority, that he is preserved from the possibility of error. That is to say, he cannot make a mistake. So when the Church, the Pope, commits himself to an idea, to a policy, then that is there to stay. No subsequent Pope can change that. They cannot change that direction, that policy, because the Pope is infallible. If a subsequent Pope were to change that policy, then it would prove that actually the previous Popes were fallible. So the doctrine of papal infallibility stood in the way, and Christianity stood in the way to birth control and abortion, because the Church had committed itself early on, was dead set against birth control and abortion. That is a sin, a mortal sin, and Western nations, Christian nations, could not even contemplate it. Therefore, the political process was not, the political establishment was not going to go against the moral establishment of the Church and institute something like a global depopulation policy. So that was the second systemic obstacle. The third one is the democratic process itself. Why? Well, imagine that you have three candidates for office. You know, Jones, Smith, and Henry. And Jones and Smith are telling people what they want to hear. You know, they're promising them the sun and the moon. But Henry says, you know, if you elect me, I'm going to institute a population control, perhaps one-child policy, just like China did in 1978, or, you know, some form of state interference with your reproductive rights. Do you think that anybody would have then or now vote for Henry, for candidate Henry? No. They would vote for one or the other of the two candidates. Yeah. So the democratic process stood in the way of legislating population control. So you had three very, very important obstacles that were just could not be overcome: lack of birth control and public awareness, Christianity and the doctrine of papal infallibility, and third, the democratic process. But in addition to that, you had a set of historical circumstances, and I'm going to go through them quickly. At the end of the Second World War, the Allied were victorious, and the Axis powers had lost. Well, Japan and Italy and Germany had unconditionally surrendered to the Allied, and the invasion, the occupation began immediately after. Upwards of 200,000 Americans were sent to Japan. and an even higher number were in Europe, helping with the reconstruction efforts and with the demilitarization efforts. So you had this animosity now between the Allies and the Axis powers. And you had a totally different historical environment where the international community had decided to avoid war at all costs. So the best way to start with a population control policy was to implement it on the losers, on the Axis powers. And this is where they began. They began by instituting population control first on Japan, Germany, and Italy, and the co-belligerent countries who were part of the Axis powers. And because they began with these three countries, Japan, Germany, and Italy, the numbers now indicate that this is indeed where the policy began. And how can we look at this? If you look at statistics, if you look at numbers, Japan is the only country in Asia who did not experience a baby boom generation. Why? Because immediately after the war, they were subjected to covert chemical fertility control methods. The same with Germany and Italy.
I thought it was because all the babies went boom in Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
They already had their baby boom.
Hiroshima and Nagasaki were horrendous, but they killed about 200,000 to 250,000 civilians. So statistically, it is insignificant. It would not have changed the demographic landscape of the country. It certainly changed the political and social landscape, but not the demographic landscape. Another indicator, another sign that shows us where the population control policy began is if we look today at which country in the world has the highest percentage of elderly and the lowest percentage of children. And lo and behold, the three highest countries are the Axis powers. Japan, number one, because that's where the policy of controlling population began. So Japan now has 24% of its population is elderly, that is to say 65 or over. That is more than they have 18-year-olds and under, more than they have children. They have more elderly than they have children, 24%. Germany has 22%, and Italy has 21% elderly. Germany and Italy are just about reaching the same statistics as Japan. That is to say, they will have more elderly than they have children. So this is another clear sign that they started interfering with people's ability to procreate in the countries that lost the war because there was a lot of animosity, and it was the perfect opportunity to test their chemical methods on these guinea pigs. So they used the Japanese population, the German population, the Italian population as guinea pigs to see if the methods work.
Can I ask, what methodologies were they using? Were they using chemicals in the water supply? What?
That is exactly what I want to talk about. The first method used...
I'm sorry, we are coming to break. I probably should have left that question until the next segment. How about instead you leave the answers to that question till next segment? And we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. My very special guest is Kevin Galilee, and we're talking about depopulation and the agenda to control the world through controlling your reproduction. You know what they say, ladies and gentlemen? Nothing is wasted, only reproduced, apart from the human race, as it turns out. We'll be right back after the break at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Don't you go anywhere, folks. Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated and Fukushima irradiated island chained nation in the sunny slave South Pacific, where the rad level is so high that most people have now adopted a part-time job as an eco light bulb, which is good for the economy, especially the mercury in their bloodstream. And my very special guest is Kevin Galilee. And like the Sea of Galilee, he's unleashing an ocean of information about depop elation. Thank you very much for joining us for a full 2 hours today. It's actually quite an awesome show so far, and it's your fault.
So yeah. we were talking about Japan.
Yeah.
I was just about to divulge the first method of population control that was used on the Japanese and all the other Axis powers. But before I say what it was, I just should mention that Japan is an island nation with very limited natural resources, an already very large population, and a modern economy that demanded, you know, vast imports of foreign resources. Japan was really the ideal testing ground for aggressive fluoridation, which was the only tried and tested fertility-depressing agent known at the time. The Nazis had used it on the Jews, and the Soviets had used it on their Gulag prisoners. And it was found to be not only extremely effective both for sterilizing men and women, but also in inducing a kind of bovine state of obedience and submissiveness, which explains...
May I ask, what's the evidence that the Nazis and the Soviets used this on people? Because I've heard this before, it makes sense to me, yet I've never seen any direct evidence. And I've talked to, Dr. Paul Connett from the Fluoride Action Network about this, and he says that it's not true. But he didn't show me any documents or evidence to prove his case either.
The reason there is no evidence, because the evidence has been censored out of the public record. There have been several mentions of this during the Nuremberg trials, but they have been cut out subsequently. And nobody was allowed to speak on this issue, none of the lawyers on either side, during the Nuremberg trials.
They were planning on using it in further, and if it had come out during the Nuremberg trials and become part of the public record, then they wouldn't be able to continue this public, in inverted commas, health policy being instituted.
And not only were they planning on using this this method, but they were planning on using the people with the expertise. The only people with the expertise. And this is the very, very interesting part. Now, in Japan, the work of poisoning the Japanese with fluoride was accomplished by the Japanese themselves. And who? Well, the war criminals from Unit 731, which was a military unit within the Japanese military that had been conducting lethal human experiments on civilians since 1937.
These are the ones that took prisoners from Manchuria and China,
yes,
and experimented on them, huh?
Among other things. The members of this unit, which was officially known as the Epidemic Prevention and Water Purification Department, what an adequate name for fluoridating the water, were given immunity from criminal prosecution at war's end by General MacArthur, who was the supreme commander of the Allied forces. And instead of being executed for murder and war crimes, they were put to good work on sterilizing their fellow nationals. And many of these of the scientists who belonged to the Unit 731 went on to stellar careers within the ranks of the political establishment in Japan and civil service. So the Japanese themselves poisoned their own population.
And so it's like the Japanese equivalent of Operation Paperclip to a large degree.
Yes, and it was, of course, the material was supplied by the Brits and the Americans, but it was the Japanese themselves who put fluoride in the water, God knows at what concentrations, because there was certainly not at the tender and limited concentrations of today. And this is why it works so beautifully. In the countryside, where there were no water treatment plants, they were handing out fluoride pills along with their rations, with the food rations. As you well know, Japan was devastated after the Second World War. The population was starving, and they were fully dependent on food rations for several years.
And that's part of the reason why the Japanese tried to surrender a number of times, but weren't allowed to surrender until after the nukes were dropped, because they wanted to see what it would do.
Yes. Having unconditionally surrendered meant that the Japanese had to submit to whatever the Allied powers would institute after the war. And all the help that they received, the reconstruction effort, and the reconstruction money that Japan and Western Europe received from the United States came obviously with conditions. And one of the conditions was that they would have to accept a population control policy. However, this was not something that was declared. It was not the politicians of the day were not given a choice. This was purely a military operation, and this is why it was conducted by military forces. And this is why the Allied used military units from within the Japanese army. And this is why they needed to give those war criminals immunity from prosecution, because you wouldn't have to convince, you know, war criminals to commit, to continue to commit crimes against humanity. They had already done so.
They've got the qualifications necessary for the job.
Exactly. They had the immorality needed to do this. So, if you want to put it in a more political perspective, the Americans have used evil to good ends, if you want. So they have used those evil people within Unit 731, who were known for having murdered tens of thousands, to achieve a demographic outcome that, in the long run, you could argue, it has helped the country achieve stability, peace, and prosperity. And we'll talk about that later. For the time being,
apart from the fact that it takes currently now about three generations to pay off one residence in Japan, in the city.
Yes.
And on top of that, they have a enormous need for foreigners to come into the country, because they simply don't have enough people of youth and working age to even sustain the country.
Yes, the situation is dire indeed, but that is the price that every nation has to pay in the demographic transition. And what is this demographic transition? Well, the demographic transition is a transition from a natural population growth, which, if you were to visualize it, it looks like a pyramid. That is to say, very few old people at the top of the pyramid, and a lot of young people and children at the bottom of the pyramid. Because with every generation, in a natural population growth, the population increases. That is to say, you know, every couple has it used
2.4.
to have. Well, the total fertility rate used to be 3, 4, 5, or 6, depending on the country. Most Western countries had a total fertility rate of about 4 at the end of the Second World War. That is to say that every couple in the Western world had 3 to 4 children. That means that the population would basically almost or nearly double with every generation. So the purpose of introducing, or the first objective of a population control policy, is to bring the total fertility rate, that is to say the number of children per couple, from a natural level of 3 or 4 or 5 or 6, depending on the country, to what is called replacement level fertility. That is to say, 2 children or less. If a couple, a man and a woman, has only 2 children, and every man and woman, every couple in the country has only 2 children, the population will neither grow nor decrease. It will stay stable.
Yeah, but there's still accidental deaths and things of that nature. In order to maintain the population, to prevent extinction, you need a minimum of 2.4.
It actually depends on how high or how low the death, the mortality rate is. So the better, the richer the country is, and the better the medical system is, and the longer people live, you need, for most Western countries, the replacement level fertility is 2.1. The poorer a nation is, the more desperate the economic conditions are, the higher the mortality is, then you'd need 2.4, 2.5, 2.6 total fertility rate to compensate for the loss of life.
That's kind of ironic. That's kind of ironic considering the United States has one of the worst birth mortality rates in the world.
That did not used to be the case. This is a very interesting point you're making. At the end of the Second World War, around 1945, 1950, until about 1955, 1960, actually the United States had by far the best statistics in terms of mortality, child survival, health, and so on. But because implemented more and more covert chemical and biological methods to control fertility that in turn also damaged the entire body and the endocrine system, the health of the population has diminished from decade to decade. And now the United States ranks somewhere between place 37 or 50, depending on which ranking agency you're looking at.
So similar fall in education happened around the same time period as well.
Yes, and I suspect that is intentional too, because it was decided that it's not exactly helpful to have a well-educated public, that it is better to just simply teach them skills that are, you know, necessary to make this, that, or the other, so that the people are economically viable, but they cannot make political decisions on their own. They can be easily delegated, easily manipulated, and easily convinced to do what is not necessarily in their own best interest. That is why education has changed from one which was all-encompassing. It was the purpose of education in the past generation was to give people a broad view to be able to think for themselves and so on. Now it's very specific. It's just teaching people skills, you know, how to bang a nail, how to fix a pipe, how to teach mathematics, and so on. A very, very, very limited set of skills. But to go back now to the methods used. So fluoridation was the first one and the most well-known one. But I want to put things in perspective, to give people a sense of how population control has proceeded, I want to mention a variety of methods. And I have basically listed them in two categories, direct methods and indirect methods. Among direct methods, you have three possibilities, broad possibilities. One, legislation, which is what China did. China introduced the one-child policy in 1978. With Deng Xiaoping. The moment Chairman Mao died, the new leadership listened to the international community, saw the writing on the wall, the population was growing too fast, and they're going to face tremendous food shortages in the future. And in 1978, introduced the one-child policy.
A friend of mine named his cat Chairman Mao.
Pardon me?
A friend of mine named his cat Chairman Mao.
Chairman Mao or just Mao?
Meow.
Meow. So,
and he did institute a one-curtain policy as well.
That is the most straightforward method to control population, through legislation. But, of course, a democratic country could not do that for the reasons that I mentioned before. The democratic process stood in the way, the doctrine of papal infallibility, and so on. China, being a one-party state, where the political leadership makes the law, sets down the law, and dictates it, and it is enforced across the country without any ifs, buts, and maybes. China was in a position to do that because of its particular political structure, being a dictatorship, if you want, or a one-party state. Call it whatever you want. The second method that is among the direct methods is a coerced surgical sterilization. This is the method chosen by India, for instance, or Indonesia, and several other countries, but India being the most the primary example because of its huge population. So, coerced surgical sterilization, what that means is that both men and women are subjected to surgery to sterilize them. Women are subjected to a tubal ligation, which takes about 7 minutes, and men to vasectomies, which takes about sorry, tubal ligation takes about 30 minutes, and a vasectomy takes about seven minutes. But because men have more power in Indian society, it is the women who are sterilized, not the men, in the vast majority. So today, in India, 80% of all women of childbearing age have been surgically sterilized, usually against their will. And how does that work? Well, it works through mobile medical caravans and sterilization camps. The Indian government has done this in several steps. They tried it in 1952 by rounding out the poor. That didn't work. It almost caused a revolution. Then Indira Gandhi tried it in 1978, again by selecting only the poor, and that was an abysmal failure. But in the meantime, they had learned their lessons, and now they do it through conniving ways. That is to say, you have mobile medical caravans going across the country through the rural, to the villages. And India's population, 80% of Indians live in villages, and many of them are not necessarily well educated, and therefore easily deceived. And when the medical caravan pulls into the village, it says, "We offer free medical care for any women who have had, you know, two children or more. Free medical care, free medicine, and so on." So the women obviously flock there because it's a fantastic opportunity to see a doctor. And they put them under, and within half an hour, they perform the operation, and they walk out of it. They don't even know that they've been sterilized. They feel, obviously, pain. They're given some antibiotics, and that's it. And this is how India has achieved an 80% sterilization, which is an unbelievable accomplishment given the size of the population. At the same time, it hasn't worked as well as legislation, and I'll discuss that later, the successes and failures of each method. So we have legislation in China. We have coerced surgical sterilization in places like India, Indonesia, and other countries. And then we have covert methods, the methods chosen by the Western world, by freely elected democratic governments who could not go the Chinese way or the Indian way. So the Western nations have...
Well, hold on. Let's stop it there, and we'll continue to talk about the Western covert sterilization techniques after the break, ladies and gentlemen. Kevin Galilee is my guest. You are listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show.
The world we knew is gone. The conditions which framed and taught us our standards have gone with us. Our needs are now different.
Hold on, sleep.
The conditions which framed the world we knew is gone.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the show where the music just never stops, on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Kevin Galilee is my very special guest. Now, let's talk about Western depopulation, covert Western depopulation. And it's interesting, as we're running through this, to see the different methodologies that the elite use to depopulate the First World, the Second World, and the Third World. Isn't it? They've got all different methodologies. Are you uneducated? Well, we're going to do this to you. Are you slightly educated and slightly sophisticated? Well, we're going to do that to you. Are you really educated and sophisticated? Well, we're going to do this to you and not tell you about it.
The different methodology, Vinny, was dictated by the various levels of infrastructure. For instance, you know, you cannot possibly fluoridate the water if you don't have water treatment plants. And most of the developing world does not have that. Certainly Africa doesn't, where most people drink out of rivers, wells, and puddles. So let's now list the covert methods that, for the most part, have been employed in the developing world. We have two categories there, chemical methods and biological methods. Among the chemical methods, I've already mentioned fluoridation. However, we have to distinguish here because fluoridation has been used in various ways. Either they have fluoridated the water, the salt, or the milk, or fluoridation has been done through the dental programs directly in the mouth. Now, let's take water fluoridation. Most of the water fluoridation was done by fluoridating the tap water. But when you fluoridate the tap water, you can only reach the population in the cities. You cannot reach population in towns with less than 10,000 people because it is not economically viable to have a water treatment plant. So since the population is easier controlled, easier poisoned, if you want, into infertility in the cities, the fluoridation agenda has gone hand-in-hand with urbanization. This is why now we have, in the Western world, rates of urbanization upwards of 80%, in most countries 90%. So it doesn't work in cities with less than 10,000 people. So what do you do? How do you fluoridate? How do you limit the fertility of people in the Western world who live in the countryside? Well, they have done it either through school programs in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, where they had mouth-washing, mouth-rinsing programs, and children had to do it in the school every morning. They have done it through a direct distribution of fluoride pills. That worked until about the 1970s. And now it has been taken over by direct applications in the mouth with fluoride veneers, which is applied by your dentist. So if you live in the countryside, chances are that it is your dentist who is sterilizing you and not the water, because the water you drink is not fluoridated. Another loophole that was to close this discrepancy between the cities and the countryside, there was also a movement to switch bottling from glass bottles to plastic bottles. And I will talk to that about that later. But initially, the water was fluoridated. The mineral water or bottled water was fluoridated in rich Western nations that already have a tradition of drinking bottled water rather than tap water. So, for instance, in most of Western Europe, especially in countries like Italy, where bottled water consumption covers 80% of the population, it made no sense to fluoridate the tap water starting with the 1980s and onwards. It made a lot more sense to fluoridate the bottled water. And this is what they did. They fluoridated only the bottled water.
What's interesting is that on the European drinking water labels, they actually have the fluoride listed on there, whereas in the rest of the Western world, they do not put the fluoride on the label.
Yeah, they have it. They have it listed now, but they didn't have it listed in the 70s and 80s when it counted the most. The reason they list it now is because they don't use water fluoridation anymore. They switch to either salt fluoridation or other methods, which I'll discuss. But about 50% of Western Europe uses salt fluoridation. Countries that are formerly water fluoridated, like Holland, France, Germany, and so on, are now using salt fluoridation. So we have water fluoridation through either bottled water or tap water, depending on the culture, depending on the country and level of development. Then you have salt fluoridation. Salt fluoridation was developed in Switzerland initially, and starting in the 1970s, it has been applied throughout the Western Hemisphere, that is to say throughout Central and Latin America and Mexico. Today, every country in the Western Hemisphere is using salt fluoridation. Why is salt fluoridation preferable for countries that are poor? Because it's not the government that pays for the poison or the cities. It is the consumer. When you go and buy your salt at the grocery store, you are buying your fluoride along with it. And because the salt is fluoridated, and this is how fluoridation is done in these countries, the consumers are not given a choice between fluoridated and non-fluoridated salt. All salt is fluoridated throughout the Western Hemisphere, with the exceptions of some countries that are using water fluoridation as well as fluoridation through the dental programs, such as Argentina, Brazil as well, and a few other countries. So you fluoridate the salt, the water, or the milk. Milk fluoridation is chosen by a very few countries. Why? Because it's probably the most immoral, as it targets only the youngest. So, milk fluoridation is used widely in Thailand. It was used in Bulgaria and Macedonia, in certain areas of China, about 2,000 schools, for instance. And I suspect that this is done partially in areas that are populated by ethnicities rather than by Han Chinese. But milk fluoridation is immoral because it is distributed through three school milk programs. So that is to say, the government doesn't give anybody anything for free. So when the government comes up with a program saying we're going to distribute milk for free and we're going to subsidize it, as they do in Thailand, where every child gets 5 baht per day, that baht is their currency, to buy their poisoned milk, you know that something is fishy. So Thailand...
New Zealand just started a school milk program a month or two ago, like restarted it kind of thing. Would you say, I mean, without looking at the evidence, would you speculate that that's part of the agenda here to fluoridate New Zealand children?
Canada has started too. And why should we be very weary? Because a few years ago, the World Health Organization has declared fluoride as a vital nutrient. Therefore, it can be added to food and be counted as a nutrient and doesn't even have to be listed. In other words, they're doing us a favor by enriching our milk and our food with vital nutrients. Of course, fluoride is anything but a vital nutrient. Nevertheless, it now has acquired this classification thanks to the good work of the World Health Organization. So you cannot trust anything.
It's not a vital nutrient, it's a vile contaminant.
It is one of the most poisonous, most toxic substances on Earth. You know, a spoonful will kill you. Everybody knows that. Anyway, let's go back to the list. So you have water fluoridation, you have salt fluoridation, you have milk fluoridation in a select few countries. Then you have BPA plastics. People have heard of bisphenol A, perhaps most commonly known as BPA. That is to say, plastic bottles. And why was this method devised? Because in the 1980s, people started mistrusting the water supply and the tap water, and they started buying more and more bottled water, a trend that began in Europe and spread to North America. When the government realized that people were no longer drinking their poisoned tap water, they're now drinking bottled water, they had to close that loophole. But all the water and all the beverages up until 1980 were coming in glass, not plastic. Everything was glass, bottled in glass. Well, they switched to plastic, which is now filling our landfills and makes absolutely no environmental sense because they needed to deliver poison to the fertility depressing agents that people now were escaping by not drinking tap water anymore. So they started bottling everything in BPA plastics. BPA is an endocrine disruptor and lowers fertility and has the exact same effect as fluoride in this respect. It attacks the endocrine system and lowers fertility, and of course, as a side effect, does all kinds of other damage.
Not only in plastic bottles have they inserted this BPA, but also I've been led to believe that all major printer companies as well, so it's in every bit of ink. So whenever you get a receipt from buying your plastic water bottle, as soon as you touch the ink on it, you get the effect too.
Yes, but you don't eat that. However, or drink that. BPA is not only the plastic bottling, it is also the epoxy resin that is used to line metal cans. So everything you buy, whether it's canned beans or canned mushrooms, it comes in cans that have been lined with epoxy resin made out of BPA. There's a very recent study done by Harvard University which has shown that if you eat canned soup for a couple of weeks, your BPA level in the body rises from 0 to 1,500%. So you have 1,500% more BPA in your body than you would otherwise. And this causes havoc with your fertility and with your endocrine system. Now, it's very interesting because most people who eat out of cans are the poor. It's poor people who don't have the money to buy, you know, fresh fruit and vegetables, and they eat canned stuff instead. And of course, in so doing, they are receiving endocrine disruptors, and their fertility is attacked from multiple directions. And of course, this depopulation policy has a eugenic side to it, because they're trying, first of all, to limit the numbers at the bottom, and less so for people of higher socioeconomic status. And the people now at the bottom of the economic rank are receiving endocrine disruptors from every direction, from their bottled water, bottled beverages, from their canned soups and canned vegetables, and even from the water they drink at the tap if they happen to live in a city that's bigger than 10,000. So you have fluoride, you have BPA plastics, and now the latest one, which started in 1995, is aerosol aluminum spraying. Everybody knows that as the phenomenon of chemtrails. The reason they started spraying aluminum in 1995 is because in 1994, a brilliant scientist in the United States discovered that aluminum combined with fluoride is far more damaging to the human body than half the quantity of fluoride alone.
Yeah, and also fluoridation is supposed to be around one part per million, and what I discovered is that in order to contaminate drinking water to the point where it's not fit for human consumption with aluminium is one part per million. So if you spray even one chemtrail over a populated area and the water catchments and everything like that, you've contaminated the entire water supply for the whole city.
Exactly. And this is why they spray usually over large aquifers. Say, for instance, in California, they're spraying over Mount Shasta a lot, because Mount Shasta in California is...
meltwater.
It's a very high, very tall mountain with eternal snow at the top, and it feeds every river and creek for... 300 miles radius.
They found that there was a 30,000 parts per million, and just in the meltwater, I think on the top of Mount Shasta, didn't they? Something insanely high.
Yes, and the reason they do that to that degree around Mount Shasta is because it is also a refuge of environmentally sensitive people, organic growers, hippies, and so on. Mount Shasta, as you know, is the hippie mecca of the United States. So they don't want these people to escape the poisoning methods that everybody else is subjected to. So they're trying to shut down their grow operations, their organic farms, and they do this through aluminum. Why? Because aluminum, yeah, sprayed from the top, combined with barium and some other toxic, noxious stuff, kills the plants, the soil. The soil can no longer be used for agriculture. And many of these people have found that they had to shut down their farms and they had to move because they could no longer grow anything in the soil.
There's no defense against a methodology like this. I mean, what are you going to do? Buy a surface-to-air missile?
Yeah. So you see that their methods dovetail. That is to say, aluminum spraying is not only used to increase the toxicity of fluoride in the body, but it is also used to remove people from the land and to shut down organic growers. And because they once they shut down the organic growers and that land can be made available to agro businesses, large agro businesses that have developed aluminum-resistant seeds.
So now, I'm sorry, Kevin, we've been cut off by the break again. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, at thefinnyeastwoodshow.com. Don't you go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the show that's all about depopulation on American Freedom Radio. And my very special guest is Stephen Gallilette. I've forgotten throughout the broadcast because... Kevin, sorry. I'm bad. I'm so terrible with names. Kevin Gallilee is my guest, and I have forgotten to ask him for a website so that if you, the listener, are interested in his work and the discussion that we've been having thus far today, you can actually go and visit him. I know that you're on Facebook, but have you got a website?
I used to have several, but I was shut down. As you well know, I've been imprisoned 6 times over the past 3 years. So now I use the proxy websites. I use Academia, who is a very reputable website for academics. And you can find all my publications free of cost. I use ScriptD for those people who want to support me financially by buying my books, you know, for $5, which is the price they're being offered at. So ScriptD, Academia, and also LinkedIn. I have a very prominent account on LinkedIn where I post just about everything.
If you could please, after the show, like right after the show, just copy-paste those things into the Skype chat, and I'll include them in the archives so that people can go through.
Yeah.
All right. So, final segment here. We only have a few minutes left, and I want you to wrap up your case as it stands. I don't know where you're going to go with this, but I just want to follow. Please go ahead.
I will cut it short. I was talking about chemical methods in detail. Just want to mention that a couple of biological methods. The method of choice now that is going to slowly replace everything else is GMOs. GMOs work beautifully wide. Now, there's too much resistance to fluoridation. People are getting smarter, and many cities are voting against it. Fluoridation is not applicable to the developing world, as I said, either. So it doesn't work for the countries where the population is growing fastest. So GMOs were developed specifically for this. And this is why now 90% of the corn crops, for instance, throughout the Americas are GMOs. They're doing the same to cotton, rice, you name it. All of the African staple crops, cassava, bananas, sweet potato, are all being turned by hook or by crook into GMO crops. Everybody knows the story of how Monsanto and several other European and North American giants are buying up all of the heirloom seed companies, and they're shutting down people's ability to choose between regular heirloom seeds and GMO seeds. So now, whether you like it or not, you're going to be planting your next crop with GMO seeds. That is the method of choice for this century to control population. Of course, population can be tackled two ways, either by controlling fertility, that is to say, by limiting the number of people born into the world, or by increasing morbidity and mortality, that is to say, by increasing the number of people who die, who leave this world. In the developing world, in countries that have not cooperated willingly with the global depopulation policy, the latter method has been used. That is to say, they've increased morbidity and mortality. And HIV/AIDS was specifically developed for this reason and for sub-Saharan Africa. And we know exactly what kind of havoc it has wreaked there over the past 30 years.
Well, part of the reason that AIDS has been so prolific in Africa is because you're 50 times more likely for it to actually bond with your blood and infect you if you're black.
Exactly. It was developed so it targets specific genetic codes, and the code of black people was the target population, and it was the HIV AIDS was delivered to the population through a smallpox vaccine administered by the World Health Organization until 1980. That's when it was introduced into the population of Africa. Some in Brazil and also in Haiti. Those are the three countries that were targeted. And now, since we don't have too much time to deal with further methodology, I just want to mention the different phases of the depopulation policy. What are the intentions, that is to say? Well, phase one was the objective of phase one was to bring down the total fertility rate of every country to replacement level. That is to say, 2 children per woman or less. And this has been basically accomplished with a few exceptions, mainly in Africa, a couple of countries in the Middle East, a few countries in the Far East. But by and large, the entire world now has reached replacement level fertility. And that target was set for the year 2000. It was supposed to be done by then. They more or less achieved it. Now, phase two of the depopulation policy, the objective of phase two is to ensure that the global population does not exceed 9 billion and that it peaks by 2040 or at the latest by 2050. This is why over the next three decades we're going to see an incremental growth in the number of fertility-depressing methods and also the intensity with which we're being subjected to them. Not in the Western world, because we have already reached our demographic transition or accomplished the demographic transition since we have been subjected to poisoning for 6 decades now. But in the developing world, they're going to be at the receiving end from now on. So phase two, the population must peak at 9 billion. Come hell or high water, it cannot go above 9 billion because it can, we simply do not have the food to even remotely feed 9 billion people. And this is going to cause way too many disruptions if it's allowed, the population is allowed to grow beyond that. Phase 3, from 2040 or 2050 onward, is to ensure a steady population decrease. So once every country has reached replacement level TFR, the population has peaked by 2050, and every country's population will start slowly decreasing. And the decrease is going to be gradual, and it's going to be controlled, and it's going to, how far it goes, how fast, depends on the country's ability to support its population, on the economic conditions, and the wealth of the country, and so on. But these are the three phases of the depopulation policy. And what I must say, you know, now to dispel all these claims that, you know, that the depopulation policy is malevolent, yes, the methodology is definitely malevolent. It is evil, and we have seen how evil has taken advantage of our best qualities in the Western society. It has taken advantage of our democratic process and of our Christianity, our moral Christian values. But it is not malevolent. Why? If they had done absolutely nothing in 1945, if they had not started limiting population, by now the entire world would be burning. We would have twice as many Westerners, and twice as many Westerners who already consume 50% of the world's resources would mean that Westerners alone would have displaced every other country and a nation and people on this earth. We would have needed all of Africa's resources, all of Central America, all of the Americas resources, just to feed and to satisfy the needs of the Western population. If they hadn't introduced population control methods in the developing world, in Africa and in the Americas, in Asia, the population would have been so much higher now. We would have had 2 billion extra people on this earth. 2 billion more people than we have now. Today we have 7 billion. We would have had 9 billion. Not only would we have had 9 billion, we would not even have started the process, the difficult process of going through the demographic transition. And if they would have waited until today, it would have been too late. Why? Because demographic outcomes or goals take generations to accomplish. Just to bring down the total fertility rate in the Western world has taken 2, if not 3 generations. Imagine how much more difficult it is going to be, and that was for the developing world, how much more difficult it will be to accomplish this in the developing world. So if they had done nothing, all of us would have been far worse. The entire world would have been burning by now. It would have been
theoretically
a nuclear war by now, fighting over the meager resources left. We would have
theoretically,
had
Because at the same time as reducing the population, they've also made lengths and strides of reducing the intelligence of said population.
Yeah.
Maybe if people weren't so stupid and dumbed down, they would have seen the scumbaggery, which is actually destroying all the resources and contaminating the environment, and gotten rid of it, theoretically.
The damage that has been done to the genetic and intellectual endowment of humanity was not intentional. It is the unintentional side effect of long-term chronic poisoning. Just think about it. Even if you took medicine for whatever ailment you have, you still have side effects. There's no such thing as medicine without side effects. Imagine what poison would do. Nobody could even dream of chronically poisoning the population for decades, for over multiple generations, without expecting severe damage done. However, it was not known. And once they had committed themselves to those desperate methods of population control, these covert chemical methods, because they had no other choice, because they could not legislate it, there was no going back. Why? In order to change tack, to change from covert methods to overt methods, that is, from covert poisoning to overt legislation, you have to tell people what you have done until now to control the population. Otherwise, people will say, whoa, we're doing just fine now. Look, population is decreasing, total fertility is decreasing, nobody has more than two kids. They would say, you know,
everybody's getting cancer, half the people are sterile.
But the reason the population has decreased is because they've had the foot on the population brake for six decades. Yes.
Well, we've only got about 30 seconds left in the broadcast. Final words.
Final words. If they had done nothing, we would all be much worse off. But because they have done it for so long, the damage done to us, to the genetic and intellectual endowment, is so great that this methodology cannot continue. If it continues, we'd all be too stupid to function.
Indeed. So despite the fact that we're in a better place, we're also in a worse place as well. It's a catch-22. Thank you very much, Kevin Galilee.